The Sports Illustrated Media Podcast is brought to you by FanDuel, the leader in one-week fantasy football, with more winners and more payouts than any other site. Enter promo code MEDIA, M-E-D-I-A, at FanDuel.com for a bonus match of up to $200. We're also sponsored by the SeatGeek app, the easiest way to find a great deal, pay for your ticket, and get to your seat. Download the SeatGeek app and enter our code MEDIA, M-E-D-I-A, for $20 off your first purchase.
You know, I didn't want it to be a situation where people knew I was gay, but I wouldn't talk about it, or they thought maybe others didn't know, or I thought maybe people didn't know. You know, I wanted it to make it a public piece of knowledge, more so for my own personal, you know, gratitude, for my own personal situation, or my own, you know, I'm not trying to have a cathartic experience or anything like that. It was just a matter of, I just needed to be out there.
They did some assessments and they're like, you know, their mother hasn't been able to take care of them. They looked at all the cases from the wall. They're like, these kids have been in and out of homes for 2 weeks at a time, a month at a time. They're like, this is not stable. And, you know, at the time, I couldn't read. I was 9 years old, and I couldn't read. I had, like, the reading comprehension of a four-year-old. I barely knew my ABCs. They're like, we keep sending them back. Like, there's going to be no hope for these kids. So they took my mom's rights away permanently, and from then on, we were put in school, and unfortunately, down the line, we were put in different foster homes, which is a bummer.
Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each week we interview members of the sports media about the process of their work and interesting people about how they consume their sports media. Today we have two guests. The first is the ESPN commentator Israel Gutierrez. He co-hosts an afternoon show on The Ticket in Miami. He's part of the ESPN's NBA coverage. He's a sideline reporter, frequent member of Around the Horn and the Sports Reporters, also writes for ESPN.com, previously worked as a reporter and columnist for the Miami Herald and the Palm Beach Post, and in early September wrote a really poignant post about coming out, discussing his sexuality, saying he was gay and was getting married to the love of his life, which he just did in the middle of September. And it was a pretty big moment for a well-known sports media person to let people into his lives in that way. And we'll discuss that and what that means and how he thinks he'll be perceived heading forward, whether there are people within the business who will view him differently because they now know his sexuality and all the topics that come with that. But he's an interesting guy, and I think that'll be an interesting conversation. Our second guest is Francesca Weems. She is a reporter for Hawaii News Now, a sports reporter and an anchor. And she has an amazing story in that she and her brother were pretty close to homeless growing up in Hawaii, went through the foster care system many times, ended up sleeping in bathrooms, in hospitals. The Francesca will be honest and talk about that their mother was, I believe, had some mental issues, maybe schizophrenia. But this was a girl who really, in terms of getting sort of the odds against her, had a lot of odds against her. And through immeasurable perseverance and through the help of some foster care parents, overcame her beginnings, went on to Cal Berkeley, was a track star and scholarship athlete there, and has now since worked in Jackson, Mississippi and Hawaii, and is now a burgeoning, really talented sportscaster who I think you're going to hear from and do some excellent things. And I imagine, too, probably will be an advocate as she heads forward for kids in foster care. But she's got just an incredible backstory. You know, if I would look, you just Google her name, Francesca Weems and Hawaii, and you'll see the story of she and her brother. Also involves Neil Everett of ESPN, who played a helping role in their lives. And it's just a really cool story, and I'm glad that she's going to be on. All right, so that's a long intro, but we got two guests and two interesting ones. So without further ado, I believe Israel Gutierrez is in Miami, and let's join him now. Okay, and as promised, here is Israel Gutierrez of many different places, as we mentioned at the top, including ESPN and The Ticket in Miami. He is in beautiful Miami, Florida, and we thank him for joining us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. Israel, thanks for joining us.
Hey, my pleasure, Richard. Thanks for having me.
You got it. All right. One of the things I'd like to get into at the top, and we will get into, you know, you have an interesting career going right now in that you have full-time radio gig. You do a lot of work for ESPN, including the NBA and some of their studio shows. But on September 4th, you wrote a very poignant post on your blog titled Thanks for Reading. And in that piece, you made the announcement publicly that you were gay, you were in love, and you were getting married. That marriage has officially happened, so congrats on that. This was a very public statement, Israel, by a public sports media figure. And I think listeners will just find it interesting in terms of when did you decide that you wanted to write that piece? When did you decide you wanted to make it public? And how either cathartic, difficult, easy, joyous was it to write the piece itself?
Well, the process is, you know, it's hard to say when I decided that I even wanted to go, quote unquote, public with it. Because like I mentioned in there, you know, I sort of came to terms with myself probably about 6.5 years ago when I met a man who's now my husband, David Kitchen. And so I knew along in the process as our relationship continued to develop and as it became obvious that we'd be together, you know, probably as, you know, probably married, I started to realize that, you know, as much as I think it was probably phrased best, I talked to John Amici about this, and he basically said, you know, you're gay the way almost the rest of the world is gay. You go to your job, you do your job, you come home, and then you live your personal life. And there's nothing wrong with that, and there's nothing different than, you know, most people. The issue with me was, you know, I couldn't just, like, I didn't want to keep them entirely separate. You know, I didn't want it to be a situation where people knew I was gay, but I wouldn't talk about it, or they thought maybe others didn't know, or I thought maybe people didn't know. You know, I wanted to make it a public piece of knowledge, more so for my own, you know, personal, you know, for my own personal situation or my own, you know, I'm not trying to have a cathartic experience or anything like that. It was just a matter of, I just needed to be out there. And in the process, recognizing that my story could possibly help other people in the future, you know, just by not being afraid to come out and, you know, all the similar things that everybody else's story hopefully will encourage, you know, whether it be youth or even older people to come out and be comfortable with who they are and recognize that it's not really that bad and that it's, you know, in fact, basically, I believe like this generation's kind of turning things in the proper direction. This younger generation where they've been around, they understand inclusiveness, they understand, you know, that it's not a choice to be gay or not, and they just kind of roll with it and they're comfortable with it. And I think we're starting to see more and more of that, but I still thought my story could help some. And what I agonized over was how to do it. And, you know, I talked to Dan Levitard about it a few times, and, you know, his advice as probably the most talented writer I know, not probably, definitely the most talented writer I know, was probably, I could probably see it coming. I mean, he basically said you should write it because the control, you know, you control the language, you control the story. You don't just tell somebody your story, cross your fingers and hope that they write it correctly. Or you don't just go on a radio show or in a television show when you've got time constraints and things like that and try to tell that story, you know, on live air. So rather than try to write it for the company that I work for and put it on, you know, ESPN.com, so it's sort of this formal story or what have you, I just decided to write it as a blog post and just share it via Twitter and have other people share it so that enough people saw it. And I thought, you know, it would be less of a formality. It would be a little bit more comfortable for me to actually write because I actually wrote it about 15 times. I just erased and rewrote, erased and rewrote. And I couldn't really tell what it was that wasn't making me happy about it. You know, I was sometimes my tone was combative and I didn't want that to be the case because I didn't want to come across as somebody who's trying to tell you how it is. I'm just trying to tell you me. So that, you know, there are times where I had to erase because of that. There were times where it just got too emotional for me and I couldn't really explain it. You know, I couldn't really explain why it was that I had to pause and just kind of broke down and couldn't finish. So it just got to a point where, and it just so happened to be 8 days before the wedding, because I knew there was going to be a time where I would have sort of my own personal deadline. And frankly, that deadline was probably like September 10th, which would be like 2 days before the wedding. But I basically just, you know, once I decided to do the blog entry, I sat down. I remember it was a Thursday night, and I hammered it out, and I was comfortable with the tone, and I sent it to Dan, and he kind of looked it over and gave me some decent advice. So I added actually a couple things and just, you know, took out a little bit for wordiness. And that night, I remember David and I were watching a movie, and we were about 3/4 of the way through it, and I just said, I'm freaking out right now. Like, I don't know what it is, but I'm freaking out. And, you know, it was because the next day, like, this would be the last day, the last night I'd be going to bed without, you know, people knowing. And it's difficult for people, you know, to go from being in a safe zone, you know, to just putting yourself out there. Right. And so I had that sort of moment, and, you know, I was calmed down a little bit. David helped calm me down. And by the next morning, I was ready to do it and, you know, hit send. Or hit publish right around, you know, just before 1 o'clock.
It's very good advice by Levitard, by the way. I think that was smart. That was the right medium for sure for you to control stuff. All right, a couple of questions off this. You said that you came out to friends and family and the people that are important to you 6 years ago or so. Did that include your employers and bosses? Did they know?
No. And let's see, 6 years. So that was when I was still at the Herald. And they didn't know, and frankly, I didn't really know back then how to handle that. I didn't know how to deal with it with my bosses and with the Miami Herald. And frankly, I didn't think it was necessary. But no, they didn't know. And then it was, let's see, 3 years later, almost three, 4 years later, where I started full-time at ESPN and left the Herald. And that was just, again, by that point, I had decided that I knew it was going to be a matter of time. I just didn't know how long a time. And no, so I didn't include the bosses at ESPN in that either. And that, you know, I kind of regret a little bit, because just as I know how, you know, I know how much I like them as people. In fact, John Skipper gave me a call day before my wedding to just congratulate me and, you know, confirm that he has my back on everything. But
cool.
I didn't tell them. I can't really say why. I just don't know why.
I want to ask you about the reaction to the blog post. You know, there's no doubt that in reading the Twitter mentions, there were people who you knew as well as people you didn't know, who came out and, you know, were incredibly happy and joyous for you. And it struck me that most of the reaction, at least publicly that I could see, was really positive. Now, you would obviously be getting all that reaction. Was that consistent, that there were, for the, generally speaking, especially through vehicles of social media, that people were happy, appreciative of you, respected your decision for coming out and letting people know who you were? Or were there also some negative feedback to that, too?
I was pretty surprised at the lack of negative comments, not even as like in terms of just, you know, people that would be angry. I expected some jokes, you know, I expected some humor in sort of a negative context or a negative tone. And I didn't really get any of that. Like I think the worst I got was people saying, nobody cares. And we already knew, sort of that combination, like that dismissive combination, and say, we don't want to hear about it. And, you know, the other one being, you know, I wish we didn't have to hear this. I wish there was a time where we're, you know, this wasn't a story. And believe me, I'm on the same page. I wish nobody had to, you know, hide for years and then, you know, eventually say who they are, or tell who they are. I wish it wasn't a case where people were afraid. And like I said, I do think we're getting to that point. But no, overall, the negativity wasn't there. And I think you know, that's probably the product of me sort of writing it a million times, because that's the one thing I definitely, like I mentioned, I didn't want to be combative. I didn't want to sound offensive. I didn't want to give anybody a reason to be upset. And if you read the story, if you read the blog post, you know, there's, I just don't see how you could read that and just get angry. You know, you're just hearing, you know, my story, my opinion, and even my opinion isn't very strong on there. It's more just my actual acts from, you know, my 38 years of life. So I don't know if anybody can actually be mad about what they read. And I think that probably came across in the reaction, because I didn't give anybody a tea. I didn't give them anywhere to sort of go off from. So I think it was eye-opening to a lot of people in that respect, because, you know, I got a lot of reaction that basically said, you know, I never really thought about it the way, you know, your story tells of this experience. I never really thought about people experiencing their lives that way. And it's eye-opening. And most, you know, I've gotten people from very religious backgrounds congratulating me, basically saying, you know, some version of, hey, you know, we study the Bible, but we know there are, you know, certain elements of it that aren't perfect. And we celebrate, you know, you finding love. And had other people basically say, you know, they always point out that they're not gay. But they definitely say, man, you know, it was eye-opening, and I've always supported you, and I will continue to. And, you know, thanks for telling the story. So I got to tell you, for a couple of days, it was just overwhelming. Like, I remember the day of, I just left. Like, I left my house and I just started driving for a couple of hours and running errands and doing anything to sort of keep my mind off of it. Not just because it was out there, but because of the positive, overwhelming reaction. I thought was, you know, it was a lot. It was a lot to handle when all I'm doing is telling my story and people are talking about, you know, an inspiration and Abby Wambach telling me I'm saving lives. It's kind of overwhelming and kind of surreal. And, but I understand it now. And, you know, I hope people can learn from it.
I ask this only because obviously you're part of the same terrain in terms of what you covered ESPN. Did you hear from Chris Broussard, who has been very public about being against gay marriage and things like that?
Yeah, I have not. I have not heard from Chris.
Okay. We'll just leave that there. Sports, you know, and you mentioned this earlier, that, you know, we live in a world now, Israel, where athletes have grown up with friends who are gay. Sports world is getting more progressive. It's not perfect, but it's 2015, and a lot of these social issues that were, I don't even want to say taboo, but were just sort of like, in my opinion, sort of ridiculously handled in the 60s and 70s, we're at a different place in the country. Country's opinion on gay marriage has changed. If you look at polls in terms of the majority, doesn't mean everybody believes in it, and certainly there's people who believe it's religiously, you know, however they want to do, against the Bible, et cetera, and that's fine. But in general, majority of the country now, I think, favors gay marriage. The thing I want to ask you, though, is that there are still pockets of sports that are hyper-masculine, hyper-testosterone, and I wonder how you think you will be perceived in the NBA, or NBA community. My sense is that it's not going to be, your sexuality won't be an issue at all in general for 90, 95, 98% of the people in the community, but it could be 2% or so. Have you thought about that, or even more, have you gotten any sense from the NBA community whether this would be an issue at all?
Well, for starters, you know, I think a lot of people assume that because the Gay Marriage Act, or the, you know, Marriage Equality Act passed, that, you know, we're all good. And, you know, all laws are in our favor and everything else. And there's still, you know, it's still legal to discriminate against gays at the workplace in most of the states in this country. So we're still a far way from being in a place where everybody can say, okay, you know, gays can consider themselves fully equal. So I always try not to champion too much the marriage equality thing and say, you know, we've got a long way to go to be truly equal. But in terms of the perception from the athletes, I would say I haven't really worried about that, to be honest. You know, I've been covering sports for 16 years now professionally. And, I'm always surprised, not always, but I'm regularly surprised by some of the depths of these athletes and, you know, how much they go against perception, they go against stereotypes. And, you're right. There's probably, I would say the number's probably in the single digits, like maybe 3 or 4% of the league that either is uninformed or has really strong feelings in the, you know, in the opposite direction. And I'm prepared to deal with that. I'm prepared to confront anybody who confronts me about it, and have a conversation with them, but I don't see it ever being a problem. The reaction I've gotten from players around the league. Dwayne Wade sent me a very nice message. I've gotten messages from coaches around the league. I've had a message from the commissioner of the NBA himself.
Wow, that's cool.
So I don't worry about the NBA. I'll tell you that much. I think it's one of the more, I think it's probably the most progressive league of the four, you know, major pro sports teams. I can't even picture a sport. Like, I would say baseball would be the one that would maybe worry me because there's so many different types of people in a baseball clubhouse that you don't really know, what their beliefs are, what their backgrounds are, and everything else. But again, I think as a country overall, we're just kind of evolving and getting to a more inclusive place. So I just never really worried about that. I've never thought about the, like, if people want to talk about me behind my back, that's what people are going to do. I have no problem with that. But as long as you allow me to do my job and, you know, don't act any differently toward me, then that's what I expect. And that's the only thing I would expect from anybody else. So haven't really worried about it one bit, especially not in terms of the NBA.
That's interesting. So, Adam, when that happens, does Adam Silver call you on the phone? Does he text you? Does he email you? How does the commissioner reach out?
He sent me an email to my personal account. Oh, yeah,
that's cool. I mean, the commissioner of the league steps up and reaches out. That's pretty thoughtful of him. And then one thing I would say is Israel obviously makes a good point. I don't want anyone to misconstrue. You know, there's still a lot of places in this country where gay people still have to overcome a lot of stuff. We're all sort of take our viewpoints from the prism of where we are and where we grew up. And obviously growing up in New York City, I have my own viewpoint on that when it comes to that. So that's probably obvious for anybody who follows me on Twitter as well. All right. One of the last ones here on this topic, Israel, and then I want to get to some of the things that you do for ESPN and sort of the process of how you do it. Do you think making your sexuality public will impact your future earnings and employment at all? And I don't presume it would, but I am interested if you've given that any thought.
I'd kind of be dumb to not think about that before. And when I say before, I just mean like I probably thought about it for years. And, given the company that I work for, I never thought it would be an issue for certain with my current employment. I think it would just be, make their decisions based on merit and based on the quality of my work. I never once questioned that. And I didn't really think in terms of future employment that it would be detrimental whatsoever. In fact, it might have crossed my mind that maybe other avenues could open up for me rather than just in sports media. Not that I was pursuing anything or anything like that, but if people are intrigued to hear a point of view from myself, then I would assume that, you know, they would reach out to me and get that point of view. But I don't think, I think we're probably well past that situation where people would, steer away from you just because you're a gay man or a gay woman in this business. So, I think we're past that. I think the people that run these successful companies that are in the business that I'm in are smarter than somebody that would look at that and, you know, keep that from allowing them to hire me.
All right, let's move on to you professionally in terms of your roles right now in the sports media, and you work in multiple platforms. So you co-host an afternoon show for The Ticket in Miami, right? That's one job. Working for ESPN – for this season, are you assigned to the NBA sidelines again?
Yes.
Okay, so that's another job. I know that at one point, and maybe you're still doing this, you had a podcast that you were doing with Kara Lawson that was essentially NBA related. Are you still doing that?
That was a radio show.
Radio show.
On Sundays on ESPN. That's probably going to turn into a general sports talk show.
Okay.
And probably going to be with a different co-host.
Gotcha. Okay, so that's ESPN Radio. You'd be one of the people on Sundays.
Yeah.
Okay. Am I missing any other full-time sort? And obviously, I should mention, you are a frequent guest on Around the Horn, the Sports Reporters. Maybe there's some other shows that you've done. I'm sure you've done SportsCenter hits if the topic is related to Miami, I would guess.
Well, NBA at all, really,
okay.
For SportsCenter. But yeah, I think you hit the radio. Local, radio, national, ESPN, Around the Horn, Sports Reporters, podcasting. Yeah, that pretty much covers it.
Okay.
Oh, and writing for .com.
And writing for .com.
A columnist for .com.
All right. First off, okay, that's a lot of, you know, that's obviously a lot of different hats, and it certainly all really, really cool jobs. I think people in the business would love any of those. Are you one who, are you good at compartmentalizing all these different facets? And because I think people would be interested as sort of as best as you can, how do you prepare for each?
Yeah. You have to compartmentalize because they're all so different. For example, even just the Sports Reporters or in Around the Horn. Around the Horn, I do from home. Well, not from home, but from my home city, just like all the other panelists do. And Sports Reporters, when I do that, and that's ideally twice a month, although that can be vary. I have to fly up to Bristol for that, obviously. So those are, you know, differences. In terms of Around the Horn, I mean, you know, we do a conference call at 10:30, sort of get our minds going on the topics, do some research before I leave, and then head up and do the show. And for Sports Reporters, you know, we get our topics right around midweek that we're probably going to discuss. And we write our own parting shots and have those in before we usually I try to do it before I travel up there. And then, those shows are kind of been doing them with some regularity since 2008. So those are kind of comfort level shows. And, you know, the people that run those shows make it a lot just so easy and so much fun to be a part of. That Around the Horn, that group's like a family for anybody that's on that show. And it's just because they're really good people. So, I would say those two TV shows are kind of, you know, different in that respect. The sideline reporting, it's new. It still feels new to me because it's only been basically, I'm going into my third season doing it. And the first time it happened, it was just, you know, it was just pretty sudden. It was just, I got a phone call and it said, hey, we're going to use Adande on sidelines now. We're using Adande on sidelines now. We wanted to see if you'd be interested in it. And it's something that I never really would have pursued, I don't think. But when you consider just how much it keeps you tied into the league and, you know, you get some access to players and coaches that maybe I wouldn't have as just a writer for the league. And frankly, it's a challenge. It's a lot of fun, but it's also a great challenge. When you think about how many national TV, you know, how many national NBA games I've seen in my lifetime, and it just feels so, you know, it feels like, you know, it's just fluid. It's natural. It happens. You know, they just miraculously put out this broadcast. And yet, you know, when you're actually part of it, you just realize the mechanics of it, you know, how much work goes into it and how difficult it is sometimes. And so, you know, you look at a Doris Burke and I'm 100% jealous of Doris Burke because she's so smooth at what she does. And she's gotten, she's gotten so good at it. And I know, remember one year where down here, and I think it might have been because of Stuart Scott's condition at the time, but she gave away the trophy. And I said to myself, when I first started doing the sideline reporting, I was like, I don't know how much I really want to dive into this. And then I remember seeing her do that. And I said, you know what? I guess that's pretty cool. Like, that's part of NBA history. You're going to be, in some DVD somewhere of this team winning a championship. And so I said to myself, you know, one day I kind of want to give away the trophy. And so I don't. The best way to do that is just try to really get good at this and continue to do it. And so that, I think, is probably the one job that gives me the most stress on the day of, because I want to, you know, do really well at it. And it almost feels new to me every single time. And the radio show is it's 4 to 7. It's me and Ethan Skolnick from formerly of Bleacher Report, and now he's going to be with the Miami Herald again as he does this radio show. This one's interesting because it's almost like a bonus when you consider, you know, I could stay at the ESPN gig, be perfectly happy, and not do anything else additionally. But, you know, having grown up in South Florida, listening to sports radio my whole life, and particularly, you know, loving the morning and afternoon shows, regardless of who it's been over the years, it's another one of those surreal experiences that now I'm the voice, or Ethan and I are the voices that people are going to hear in the afternoons down here in South Florida. Obviously, we have competition. Obviously, there's other people they can choose, but if they happen to choose our station, it's pretty exciting. It's a unique situation, like I said, to just be one of those voices in the town that I grew up in, and that's why I didn't want to pass this up. So, you know, if it becomes too much of a conflict, if it becomes an issue where, you know, my ESPN responsibilities are being hurt by it, I'll assess the whole situation again. But it's something that I, you know, at the very beginning couldn't turn down.
For the viewers who have watched for years the in-quarter questions by people like you, mm-hmm. Doris Burr, Craig Sager, et cetera, you know, you only have whatever it is, 25, 30 seconds to pull something off. What's your thought, as the reporter, what's your thought process when, let's say, it's you and Randy Whitman, you got 25 seconds and you've got to interview him, you know, his team's trailing in the fourth quarter and right. you want to get something out of him. So what, as the reporter, what, when you're walking into that situation, what's your thought process?
Well, I always want to have two solid questions with about 2-3 minutes left in the quarter, at least as a possibility. And what I need those questions to be are obviously open-ended, nothing that would suggest anything negative about his team whatsoever. And just, yeah, I mean, look, I've been asking questions of coaches for, like I said, 15, 16 years. And so I can kind of get an idea of what, you know, especially after speaking to them before the game, of what they're going to be okay with and what they're not going to be okay with. Some coaches, you could ask anything. I mean, you could probably ask Steve Kerr, Eric Spoelstra, any question, and they'll just, you know, they'll get the gist of it and formulate whatever answer they feel like is okay at the moment. But there's other guys that are challenging. You know, you mentioned the Randy Whitman. Randy loves to cut people off before the question's right. done because he thinks he knows what the question is. Well, sometimes he doesn't. So in that case, with a Randy, you know, I want to keep it short. I want to make it a brief question so he can't cut me off with, you know, I mean, with the guy everybody talks about, Greg Popovich. I mean, it doesn't really matter what you ask him. You could ask him the most neutral, open-ended question in the world, and, you know, he'll find a reason to not like it and give his little act. But, you know, it's become part of the NBA now. I guess it's funny, but I don't really have any sort of one strategy for any, you know, overall. I just have, you know, each individual coach, I kind of come up with a decent idea.
Okay, and on that note, we'll take a break and we'll be right back with Israel Gutierrez. Third week of the NFL season was very, very interesting. Watch out for those Bills. Think making a move. And now would be a great time to head into fantasy football. And with FanDuel, you can play with up to $200 in bonus cash using our code MEDIA, M-E-D-I-A. You've probably heard of FanDuel somewhere before. Here's what it's all about. FanDuel is the leader in one-week fantasy football with more winners and more payouts than any other site. They will pay out over $75 million a week this football season. Look, we all love fantasy football, but a lot of fans miss out because the whole season is just too much of a time commitment. FanDuel does away with all that. You can draft a team at any time, drop it in tournaments, and win weekly cash prizes. Entry fees start at just $1. There's a league for everyone. Over 1 million players have won money playing fantasy sports on FanDuel. Now it's your turn. Go to FanDuel.com and click on the microphone in the upper right-hand corner. Use the code MEDIA, M-E-D-I-A, and sign up now. There's a special offer for new users. For every dollar you deposit, FanDuel will match it with up to $200 that gets earned as you play. That's a bonus of up to $200. The offer is only good for the first 50 people that use my code MEDIA, M-E-D-I-A, so don't get left out. Don't forget to use the code MEDIA, M-E-D-I-A. FanDuel.com, where every day is a new season. That's FanDuel.com. Try it today. What's fantasy football without the inside edge? Well, Sports Illustrated fantasy expert Michael Beller serves up expert analysis and fantasy advice on not one, but two weekly episodes, the SI Fantasy Football Podcast on Monday and Thursdays on iTunes and at si.com/podcasts. One of my Twitter followers, when I put it out that I was going to interview Winston Rivas, he wanted to know how you juggled your priorities, which you just explained. Is there one of the jobs that's more important to you than another, or do you view them all the same?
Well, I kind of view writing about the NBA as sort of my anchor. It's what I've, you know, grown up or in this business doing. And so I feel, and plus it was .com that, you know, initially pursued me to ESPN before, you know, the TV side jumped in. So I would say that's, prioritize is a tough word because they all mean a lot to me, but I would say that's the one that kind of feels like my anchor. However, it's actually troubling to me that I haven't been able to write nearly as much as I've wanted to over the last couple of seasons because of all the other responsibilities. And we've seen that happen to, let's say, a Michael Smith, who went from, you know, writing about the NFL to being mostly TV or strictly a TV personality. It seems like right now, I think
Jamel was on this podcast. That's exactly what she said. She actually made an interesting point that she said she made a decision, a specific decision, not to write because she did not want to parachute into writing every now and then because she thought it wouldn't be fair to the audience, and she didn't think that she could live up to whatever standard she wanted to as a writer if she was not writing regularly.
Yeah, and I totally understand that. And if I thought that, you know, I was shortchanging people on the NBA, then I wouldn't write. But because a lot of my other jobs keep me in the NBA or around the NBA, I feel no guilt whatsoever in terms of not giving people, you know, a full example of what my writing is. So in that respect, I'm okay with it. But I do, it's a little bothersome to me that, you know, the time isn't there as much as it used to be. But it's one of those deals where maybe even this radio show, because it's, you know, it keeps you connected every single day. And so maybe, you know, I might write more just because more ideas come up this way, or who knows. I'm hoping that it all sort of works in concert where I can, grab some ideas from radio, turn that into some copy, and, you know, still be a good presence on .com. It's a tough balance, but it's one I'm hoping, you know, can figure out more and more as we go.
All right, let's finish up with these three. You mentioned Around the Horn before. You know, I know that group, Aaron Solomon and the boys. They love me on a daily basis. So let me and listen, there's no doubt that whatever even conceptual issues or things I don't like about that show, the people are there who do that show are really, really good people, and that's really, in the end, all that matters. How do you weigh the exposure that you can get on being on something like an Around the Horn, and it's clearly a very fun show to do, versus being on a show that really doesn't give you a lot of time to discuss things in depth, and a lot of times prompts sports writers into essentially coming up with a take that's memorable or a hot take, as opposed to something really thoughtful, which we might see from them in print?
My position on that is you got to know what you're watching, and you got to know what the tone is and what the idea is. Like, the idea is not to turn a Bill Plaschke or a Tim Kalishaw or a Jack McMullen or a Bob Ryan, who are guys, writers that I've grown up reading and fully respect, and anytime you read their work, you recognize why. It's not to turn them into, you know, hot take analysts, you know, with 30 seconds to speak. It's to give, you know, to have a little fun with the situation, but also, you know, give some short, brief insights into what their thought process is. I don't think, you know, people that watch the show and really enjoy the show think that we're as shallow as a 30-second, you know, opinion on any topic, much less some of the more important topics in the sports world. So, you know, it's a little bit like Ken Levitard's got a sound drop where people say, hey, you don't talk enough sports, or you don't do this, and he says, you don't get the show. Well, I kind of get that opinion, you know, of people who, maybe want to turn around the horn into, you know, meet the press or something like that. So I just think you just kind of got to get what you're watching. And I think the product that they put out on a daily basis, I think it's very entertaining. And, you know, based on feedback I get from you know, viewers and everything else, I mean, they tend to find it very entertaining as well. Of course, you know, you don't want to be flippant and you don't want to just be dismissive and you don't want to joke too much, because then maybe, you know, you won't be taken seriously. But I think that show finds a perfect balance, in my opinion.
I respect that answer, and I look forward to your career as the vice president in ESPN Communications. all right, Israel, as we finish up with you, you've covered the NBA both for a newspaper as a beat reporter, and now you're covering it nationally as a television reporter. This is an intentionally open-ended question. What's the toughest part of covering the NBA on a day-to-day basis?
That's a good question. I don't know if I ever really think of the toughest part. I would say, you know, finding unique stories from day to day, because one thing about the NBA is it's kind of predictable in terms of, you know, there's probably only, if you really think about it, three or four or five teams that can win a championship in any given year. And so, you know, if you're covering a team that's not one of those teams, you know, how many times can you tell a story? How many different angles can you come up with for, you know, a 12-man team, which really only five or six of those people are going to be, you know, worthy of a print of ink. So I would say that's probably the most difficult part of it. In terms of interviewing players, in terms of interviewing coaches and going, yeah, I don't really see much of it as difficult. You know, the sideline reporting is tough when you're asking live questions and you don't know what the answer is going to be and you don't know what the response is going to be, especially when you have to ask a difficult question. But for the most part, yeah, it's just coming up with ideas when you're talking about a league where the teams are probably, yeah, less than football, less than hockey, less than baseball. So you got the least amount of people there and the least amount of significant names as well. So that's probably the most difficult part. But on a daily basis, like the mechanics of covering a league or, you know, interviewing certain players, I mean, I don't think any of that's really tough.
What's the best NBA interview you've ever conducted and with whom?
Best interview I've ever conducted. Man, I would say the one that stands out to me the most is one I did with Lamar Odom.
Yeah.
When he first signed with Miami, we went to dinner at some hotel restaurant, I don't even remember, in South Beach or near it. And yeah, he was just so open and seemingly honest. And, you know, I, with somebody that had his issues with marijuana in the past and everything else, I didn't expect him to be as open as he was, and he was. He was great, and I thought it made for a great story. I've had so many really, really good interviews over the year, though, just because the subjects are so good and it's just so natural. You know, Ray Allen comes to mind as somebody who's always a great talker. I remember Caron Butler as a rookie. We spent sort of the day together, went like furniture shopping and stuff like that, amongst other things. And that was a lot of fun, and he was really good. But yeah, I would say probably that Lamar Odom stands out. And you know what else? I shouldn't exclude this. Alonzo Mourning. Throughout his recovery, or comeback rather, after the kidney surgery, I remember at least three interviews where he was just fantastic. I mean, he was just so willing to talk about his situation and so detailed and everything else. And yeah, he probably defined my early career in terms of, you know, writing good stories and you know, chasing difficult news and everything else. Like, Alonzo Mourning has so much to do with my early upbringing in this business. So a lot of those stories and those interviews are very memorable.
Yeah, no doubt Miami's had a lot of, South Florida's a lot of interesting players who floated through that team since 2000 or so. All right, and then finally, and again, nobody really knows the future of their career, but if I asked you 10 years from now regarding something you really feel like you have to be doing, what would that be? Would that be working somehow in the NBA? Would that be somehow on TV or something else?
It's funny because I sort of I have a difficult time answering those questions, in large part because, and I remember being in college and on my way out the door, they, you know, asked, what do you see yourself in 10 years or where do you want to be in 10 years? And I said, in 10 years, I'd love to be, you know, a beat writer for the NBA and a major metro newspaper. And I was kind of doing that within 10 months. And so once you sort of reset your goals, it's like, all right, am I setting them too low? Am I setting them too high? And I've never really set any goals going from there, from then on, from when I first got in the business. So I would love to still be working with the NBA in some capacity with the NBA, for the NBA, however you want to describe that. I would love to have some sort of presence in like LGBT activism, whether it be, you know, speaking or engagements, or whether it be something more formal. That's probably something I would be wasting my time if I didn't take part in and didn't help out with. But yeah, I would just want to continue to be a respected journalist. In what capacity, I'm not sure, but also sort of spread out a little bit and do some more, public activism type of stuff.
Well, I wish you luck with that. The guest has been Israel Gutierrez. And listen, Israel, I appreciate you you talking to us today, because you don't have to go in depth on this, and this is something very personal to you. And what you wrote could have sort of stood the test of time, but I think there were a lot of people who were interested in hearing more from you on that, and how you got that in terms of your own personal journey and what that's going to mean heading forward in terms of your professional life. So for Bette Marston and I, we appreciate your time on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, and best of luck heading forward.
Hey, thank you. It really blows my mind. Like, sometimes when I sit back and think, and I say, wow, people really know way too much about me. But for the most part, it's for the better. So I appreciate you saying that.
You got it. A lot. Thank you. Thanks, Israel.
You got it. Thanks.
We all enjoy the convenience of sports on television, but nothing compares to seeing the greatest athletes in the world up close. Now with the SeatGeek app, you can find the best deals on sports and concert tickets quickly and easily. And here's a special deal for my listeners. When you use our code MEDIA, M-E-D-I-A, you'll get $20 off your first purchase. The SeatGeek app takes less than a minute to download, and it's free on iPhone and Android smartphones. Now, SeatGeek does a ton of things that other ticketing sites don't. It aggregates from the big ticketing sites, so just like when you search for flights and hotels online, SeatGeek pulls in ticket options from hundreds of sellers. They create a one-stop shop for sports and concert tickets. When you shop on SeatGeek, you're seeing virtually every ticket option available for that game all on one page. No need to go anywhere else. SeatGeek also has the great featured deal score, ranking every ticket in the market with a 1 to 100 value score. They plot the best deals on a color-coded interactive map of the venue, so you can easily identify the best ticket values in the building at a glance. Finally, SeatGeek's mobile app makes the ticket process or buying process seamless, easy, and safe. On SeatGeek, you can store your credit card, and once you find a ticket you want to buy, you can complete the purchase with just two quick taps. There's no faster way to buy tickets. So, to redeem your promo code and save $20 on tickets, download the free SeatGeek app today. Enter promo code MEDIA, M-E-D-I-A, in the app. SeatGeek will then send you $20 once you've made your first SeatGeek purchase, even if your ticket costs less than $20. This is a sneaky good deal. And if you want to see the NFL, college football, or the best concerts, use the SeatGeek app and enter our code MEDIA, M-E-D-I-A, to save $20. Okay, now let's bring in Francesca Weems. Hopefully I pronounced her first name right. It is roughly 5:30 in the morning in Hawaii.
Yes.
She is in Oahu, and we welcome her to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. Francesca, thanks so much. You're easily the person who has woken up the earliest to do this podcast, so we appreciate that.
Yes, yes, I win. I win the cake. No, I want to thank you so much. It's an honor, you know, your lineup of people to be, you know, asked to do this podcast is amazing. So thank you.
No problem. All right, so, you know, I gave your bio at the top, and, you know, I'll sort of preamble here for a little bit before we start talking. The story that I read about you and your background is pretty remarkable, and it sort of shows, I think it's really illustrative to show people what you can overcome when you necessarily don't get the best hand dealt with as a kid. But before we get to that story and how you and your brother, you know, sort of essentially have made it out and been successful, I want to, you know, part of this podcast is about process, and people are interested in what people do. It's very interesting to talk to somebody who covers sports in Hawaii. So as specific as you can, what is mm-hmm. what is your role and what do you do for Hawaii News Now?
I'm primarily a sports reporter, and what we are, we're MMJ, so multimedia journalists, meaning everything that we put on is a top to bottom production. There are no producers, there are no editors. We do everything from top to bottom. So I shoot my own stuff, I write my own stuff, I edit my own stuff, and then sometimes we go on air to present it. So a lot of my stuff is packages. I'm going out trying to find really cool stories. I'm responsible for a weekly segment called The High Five, which is we're three local affiliates all combined into one. So we're K5, KGMB, KHNL, which is a CBS and an NBC affiliate, and then K5 is more like a CW. So we pump out content for three different networks that are local. So we're doing a lot of stuff. The High Five runs on the K5, and what that essentially is finding cool athletes that have gone on to do great stuff either that week or have been doing great stuff for a while. So some of my favorite ones so far have been, you know, I did a story on three Moanalua linemen. They're all girls. And most of the time when you see girls playing football, they're usually kickers. They're on special teams or something of that sort. So to have three ladies playing football for this Moanalua High School varsity team, and one of them starts on both sides of the ball, it was incredible. So I like to find stories like that, and then we put it to air. So yeah, top to bottom, you'll see me out there shooting. And you know, smaller markets, this is pretty common that you're an MMJ. But when I see people out and about and they see me shooting my own stuff, they're pretty surprised. Like, oh wow, we didn't know that you guys did your own stuff. We thought you had a cameraman. I'm like, nope, I'm my own cameraman. Everything you see, we put on ourselves.
So for on a given day, basically, can you turn around a piece in same day? And if so, how many hours does that take?
Yeah, I can turn a piece around in the same day. Luckily, I've been given some leeway. So a lot of those special features, I usually try to shoot ahead of time because it takes a little bit longer to sit down with the student athletes, and it works around their schedule. And a lot of times, they don't start practice until 4 p.m., so this would have to be on air at 6. That's a major quick turnaround to meet them at 4:15. So a lot of these I do like at least a day ahead of time, but I have gone in the morning and done stuff and flipped it that day. But yeah, we do a lot of obviously bow shots. I'm constantly getting stuff for our anchors daily. So today I will be headed to UH to preview their matchup against Boise State later. They practice from 7 to 9 at the university. After we talk to the coaches, we talk to the team, bring back, dump that, cut the bow shot for my sports anchor. And then, actually, the Lakers are in town. So this is a great week for us. Lakers are in town. They have their training camp here and exhibition games against the Utah Jazz. So I'll also be seeing the Lakers a little later today as well, and probably cutting a vote shot. If a package is needed, we'll go from there. But it really depends on what our sports anchor needs from that day. And if we're a sack show, he'd probably rather have a bunch of vote shots than packages, because in local sports, we only get about 3 minutes. So my package, 15-second intro, another minute and a half, that takes up like his entire broadcast. So it depends on what we have that day. He lets us know what he needs.
One of the things that's interesting to me is, you know, we're calling you from New York City, and sports journalism in New York City is as what you'd expect. It's very intense. It's very competitive. There's sort of a hard edge to it, and that you'll see that in a lot of cities like New York and Philly and a lot of East Coast cities. You know, having been to Hawaii, it's a beautiful place. It's very peaceful. It's calm. So I'm curious, does the sports coverage kind of reflect the mood of Hawaii, where it's more laid back, it's maybe sort of more featuresque, or does it have any kind of intensity or kind of East Coast feel to the coverage, where coverage may be more critical of teams, et cetera?
I do feel like our station in particular has a bit of an East Coast feel. A lot of our managers are actually from the East Coast, from you know, New York, Boston area. So they very much hone in that competitiveness to, you know, beat out our competitors for stories. I feel like our product looks very, very different compared to our competitors for that exact reason. They expect the same stuff that you probably see out in New York. They expected our product would have that. And actually, us being such a high tourist industry spot, it makes sense that we would try to keep that edge. Because just because we're local, and we may be in a smaller market, people from all over the country, people from all over the world come to Hawaii. It's a destination vacation spot. A lot of East Coasters, so we try to make sure that our broadcast have a lot of the national news as well as local content. We don't only focus on local stuff. Obviously, University of Hawaii is our bread and butter. We don't have any pro teams, so they are our number one, but we definitely shine a light on a lot of the stuff. I mean, our sports anchors were doing hits at the top of this for the Flake Gate when the ruling came down. We're doing hits at the top of the shows and stuff, so very much we stay on top of that.
All right, Francesca, I want to get into your background because you have kind of an amazing story. And, you know, in reading the pieces about you and discussing that when you and your brother were young, essentially under 10, there were nights that you didn't know where you were going to end up sleeping. And you might end up sleeping in, a hospital, a public restroom. I guess my question for you, or if we, as we start off this, would be, you're in your, later mid-20s now. How visceral are those memories? I mean, can you close your eyes and still see yourself as a, whatever it is, a 5-year-old girl, a 7-year-old girl, not knowing where she was going to end up sleeping that night?
Absolutely. And actually, you know, I was gone from Hawaii for 10 years going to school, and I worked in Mississippi. So coming back to Oahu, where it all started, my mom moved us here when we were one. I was 1 year old. My brother was 4. So a lot of the early stuff before we were permanently placed in foster care, I remember vividly. In fact, I still live about, 5 minutes from the house or one of the apartments that we grew up in down the street from where I live now. And it brings back a lot of memories. It brings back times of us being on the street. We rarely were stable. We had an apartment for a couple months and we're back out on the street. And, you know, when I saw The Pursuit of Happiness, one of my favorite movies of all time, the best way I can describe it is there was definitely a moment when we were sleeping in a bathroom at a church that had, I don't know, I guess they hadn't closed everything up, but we ended up sleeping in it. And somebody ended up knocking on the door. And there's that vivid scene in the BART station where Will Smith is with his son in the bathroom and somebody's banging. He kind of just pushed his foot to the door and just try to calm his son down as they try to sleep. And that's very much what happened with my mom, too. Same thing. Someone was banging on the door trying to get in. My mom had locked it. And we're just in this bathroom. She's kind of like just trying to calm me and Marcus down, go to sleep, kids, you know. Yeah, outside of libraries. I mean, we really had to fend for ourselves. My mom was crafty, given her inability. You know, she has a mental disability, but she did what she could. She faked being a domestic violence victim so that we could get into shelters. You know, all the things she had to go through, they weren't always the most moral, but that's what she had to do to keep us surviving, and I don't blame her for it at all. My brother and I, you know, we would take bags from one grocery store, go to another one, and fill it up with stuff. I'm pretty sure people at that store knew what we were doing, but they had compassion, so we'd buy something at the register with, like, the dollar we had on us and walk out with a bag full of groceries or macaroni and cheese. And we didn't pay for any of it, but that was our way of surviving. And Hawaii has really embraced us. And I think this place is so special in the fact that people really lend a helping hand. They really want to help people succeed. Hawaii has that just loving, embracing culture. So I feel like for her to have brought us here, if we were going to be struggling, Hawaii was going to be the best place for us to be able to succeed because we have such a great network to help us. But it was amazing. I still pinch myself. And I don't understand why I was so blessed. I know it has a lot to do with God, but I'm not sure how I made it out and so many others didn't. And I know one wrong pitfall could have changed everything, and it didn't. So it's amazing.
If I could ask, how long were you in the foster system for?
So I've been on Oahu, it started off with a week at a time, 2 weeks at a time. And so me and my brother have been out in and out of probably about 20 homes. So we would get taken away from our mother because we'd be sleeping on a private property. So at a hotel, my mom would have us in the lobby, knocked out for trespassing. So the cops would come, they would take us, and then they'd give us back to her. And so when we finally got permanently taken away, when I was about 8 and a half, it was from then on we never went back. And that was on the Big Island. They did some assessments, and they're like, you know, their mother hasn't been able to take care of them. They looked at all the cases from Oahu. They're like, these kids have been in and out of homes for 2 weeks at a time, a month at a time. They're like, this is not stable. And, you know, at the time, I couldn't read. I was 9 years old, and I couldn't read. I had, like, the reading comprehension of a 4-year-old. I barely knew my ABCs. They're like, we keep sending them back. Like, there's going to be no hope for these kids. So they took my mom's rights away permanently, and from then on, we were put in school, and unfortunately down the line we were put in different foster homes, which is a bummer. And I wish that they would try to keep kids together, and I do think they did their best to do that, but circumstances made it that we didn't live in the same home. So, but yeah, definitely it was critical. I think if it had gone on any longer than that, it probably would have been doomsday for me and my brother. So, yeah.
Whether you were 10, 12, junior high, high school, was there a particular family that eventually you found stability because you turned out to be a really good student? And you obviously went to a really good college. So there had to be a point, there had to be like a demarcation line where I would think at a certain point you found stability, or at least in the very case you found stability when it came to going to school.
Absolutely. And, her name was Jacqueline Woods. And so at the time she was actually a social worker when I entered the foster care system around 8.5, 9. And because it's a conflict of interest, you can't be a social worker working with kids and actually have them in your house. So she took on a mentorship role. She was also African-American. So, I lived with a lot of white families, Hawaiian families that didn't know what to do with my hair. And she's like, I know black hair. I'm going to take her in. We'll do her hair on the side and I'll send her back. By the time I was 14, I had been moved 6 times and kind of been lashing out because I was still dealing with everything that had gone on with my past, being homeless, being hungry, malnourished, just the crazy life that we had lived. It takes a toll on you. And so I was having breakdowns a lot. And so with her help, she really stabilized me. She showed me that she loved me. And I think that's all I needed. I needed consistency because I would test people and push them to the brink to see if they loved me. I wanted the same love that my biological mother had for me in a foster care sense. And I had not found that with any of the other families. They had all given up. We can't handle Fran. She's too much. But Jackie stuck with it. And the moment I stopped testing her is when she looked me in the eye. I was like 15. She's like, I know what you're doing. I know that you're trying to push me away. I know your habits. She's like, but I'm not going anywhere. So carry on. And so after that, I was like, oh, man, she figured me out. So I stopped. I let my guard down. I let her in. And that's been my mom ever since. She is my mom. I have a biological mother, but I also have her in my life, Jackie. And so I'm blessed to now have two mothers. She's very much involved. I definitely credit her a lot with my ability to go to Berkeley, to just focus on sports, to be normal. Because we come from such tough backgrounds. All kids want to do is feel like they're just like the other kids out on the field, just like the other kids in the classroom. All we want to do is not be reminded of the pain that we've gone through. And she did a great job of doing that. When I got in her house, she had two twins of her own. Wow. She never said, this is my foster daughter, Francesca. She said, this is my other daughter, Francesca. And people would be like, oh, I didn't know you had three. And they're like, we don't remember her. And she's like, oh, you'll see her around. She doesn't even explain it. This is my daughter. That's it. Period. End of discussion. So it's great.
They
need more parents like her.
Absolutely. I mean, if there's sort of heroes in this story, she's absolutely one. Where was your brother during this time? Did you, when you were in high school, are you able to see him? Is he, if nothing else, in proximity, is he close?
Yeah, so he lived about, I would say, 10 minutes down the road from me, which is really funny because we were in school together. So I was a freshman, he was a senior. So I'd see him in the hallway. We eat lunch together pretty much every day. But yeah, it was very odd because, like, at school was the only time I would see him, and sometimes I'd see him on the weekends, but he was also an athlete, too. We ran track together, which brought us closer because he was a very good track athlete. I was better. I might want to throw that out there. But, yeah, and he went on to play football at the University of Hawaii. I went on to run track at Cal. Sports played a very vital part of our lives. It brought us together, even when we were apart, and it helped us cope with what we had gone through because we were able to channel a lot of that energy, and we both ended up being – very good at our individual sports. Marcus better at football, me better at track. So yeah.
When you both got to college, had you caught up with the rest of your classmates in terms of where you were with your schooling and learning, or was college even still a little bit of a tough road because of your lack of schooling, let's say, between, or lack of reading from ages like 1 to 9?
Oh, I can't speak for Marcus, but I do know that both of us graduated with high earns. I don't know what Marcus graduated with, but I had a 3.9.
Wow.
And I had extensive tutoring, Marcus included. We had, when I first entered school, they put me back. So I was supposed to enter at 9 in third grade. They put me back to second grade. And so I had extensive tutoring in between. sessions in school. They would take me out of class and bring me down because there would be times where I don't understand what teachers are talking about, even in second grade. And so we didn't have any summers. We spent extensive tutoring. Like, basically, our entire summer was spent trying to catch up. And thank goodness for, I just think we just got it because we caught up very fast. Like, they were actually extremely impressed. Some of the people that were working with us, like, this kind of doesn't make sense for her not to be able to spell and really read. And now she's at the level of her classmates and then ended up becoming a Bill and Melinda Gates scholar, which is extremely difficult. One out of like 100 get these scholarships. And I met Bill Gates in 2010. So it's just a testament that if you work hard at something and you believe in yourself, no matter where you started, you can overcome it. And me and my brother worked our butts off. We didn't go out to recess. We were constantly working on our craft, and then we poured ourselves in our athletics. So, and then had part-time jobs on the side. But yeah, like, just discipline to the T, both of us. And I took a lot of that from my brother. I watched how he did it and kind of followed suit. I guess we just had an unwritten plan that we weren't going to fall into the statistics because only about 2 out of 10 end up doing something with their lives out of foster care. Most of them are dead, homeless, or in jail. 80%. It's just really disparaging. And, you know, when I got in the system, I had typecast put on me. Oh, she'll probably be pregnant at 16. She'll probably drop out, blah, blah. I didn't do any of that stuff. And I made sure that I didn't become a statistic, and my brother included. Like I said, people can put stuff on you, but you, I think with the, obviously, the help of God, you can help define your own destiny. So that's what we decided to do.
What's your earliest memory of wanting to be in the like sports broadcasting or journalism profession?
I wanted to be, I think it started, even though I did watch Neil go into the industry, I really fell in love with it in high school. We're on high school in the Big Island, has this morning broadcast program, which is phenomenal, one of the best in the state. So yeah, I got to practice as like a sophomore in high school. I'm reading just simple stuff like this is what's on the lunch menu. But we got to do packages and stuff when I was in high school. Like, a lot of kids don't get to do that. So I'm sitting in front of the camera on the anchor desk. I'm like, this is cool. I can do this. And I had obviously watched Neil. Well, initially I wanted to do news, and then I transitioned to sports after, you know, running track at Cal and being exposed to the athletic environment and getting amazing internships and opportunities to work with ESPN at a lot of games throughout the Bay Area. And I was like, I really like this fast-paced industry. I like that I am an athlete at the time, now a former student athlete, to be able to share stories like mine was really intriguing to me. And then you have the meal component. But yeah, he definitely played a role in my decision to go in this field, but it was kind of propelled by morning broadcast.
All right, so I want to like sort of spell who that out. The Neil in this story is Neil Everett, who's now a SportsCenter anchor. And when you and your brother were kids, I don't know how old you were, but when you were kids, he befriended you while he was a sports information director at Hawaii Pacific University. This is basically before he was a national broadcaster. And just in reading that story, you know, I think you said he sort of became like an uncle. He'd give you birthday gifts.
Yeah.
He gave you a bike. So can you take us sort of through his impact? And so are you essentially like a 10 and 11-year-old, and here's this guy who's a sports information director who's sort of just – opening up his life to you and making you feel like a normal kid?
Actually, so this was on Oahu. So I was actually 4 when I first met him. Okay. I was about 4 or 5 years old, and because we weren't in school, we were once again wandering like aimlessly through campus one day because we weren't in school, like I said. And Neil just happened to be on campus because that's where he worked, and he saw us, and when he retells the story, because I was so young. He just said he knew something wasn't right. He's like, you know, it's like 2 p.m. Why aren't these kids in school? My brother and I were really frail. He could tell we looked hungry. And so literally it started off with that. He's like, hey, you guys want to go around the corner and, you know, get a burger from McDonald's? And we're like, cool. So we, you know, go with Neil. My mom, like, follows. She's not going to let us go with this random guy. But we go and get a burger. He buys us a meal. And my mom is very thankful. And then he keeps seeing us. And so then I guess he just approached my mom about, hey, like, can I take them places sometime? And so I remember one time, I believe it was my 6th birthday, the electricity at our apartment, once again, had been cut off. We were about to get another eviction notice. And he came by with a dress and a birthday cake, and we had to eat it outside. because he couldn't go inside because there's no electricity. Wow. But it just it just shows how special he is, because realistically, you see, you know, two little kids. It's sad, but you know, not everybody's going to play this role. They may buy the kid a burger and move on. Neil was really touched, and he's like, you know, took my brother to basketball games, got us a bike, got me a dress. Like, he didn't have to do all this stuff, but he knew that if he could do anything to change your lives, make it more positive, that he was going to do his best. And then we lost contact for a long time because I went into the foster care system. I moved to Big Island, which kept bouncing around. But we got reunited when I was a senior in college. I was about to graduate. My mentor, Sherry, who in the Bay Area, who also went to Cal, figured out how to find him at ESPN and flew him out there for my graduation party. And so when I walked in the room, he was there, and I broke down. So I've been trying to find him and get a hold of him, but ESPN is not always the easiest to get caught. So, you know, I could be like a random stranger. So I tried to get a hold of him. No one was giving me his number. So I just broke down. So it had been a good gap since we hadn't seen each other. What is that, like 14 years?
Right.
Like 14 to 18 year gap. And I just felt like a kid all over again. Now I talk to him all the time. That's Uncle Neil. I love that man so much. So, yeah.
Did you ever either ask him, or did you ever take a guess as to why you think he did what he did? What, for whatever reason, you, like you said, he could have, you know, he could have bought you guys lunch and sort of been on his way, but he clearly made a decision to invest, and it had an impact, because look at what you're doing and look at what he does.
Yeah. He talks about this kind of underdog mentality, always helping people that are less fortunate. I guess he said he's just always been like that. I don't think he would have ever guessed that just by doing that, that down the line, I'd end up in broadcasting, working at the same station that he now used to work for, very much following a similar path. I don't think he foresaw that when he was obviously trying to help me, but I do think we realize how full circle life is. And he's really instilled that giving back in me. And so I want to work with foster kids. I'm hoping to write policy for Hawaii at some point in the near future and write a book. Obviously, Neil will need to be a very important part of that chapter. But yeah, like, he's very much about the underdogs, very much about changing people's lives. And he's done that immensely. And they continue to do that today. He's very involved with helping kids and helping foster kids. So he's awesome.
Those are, I hope you do all that. Those are ambitious but very realistic goals for you. So here's the last thing I want to ask you about. You know, you've worked in Jackson. You're now in Hawaii, back in your, you know, back in the place that's comfortable to you. Realistically, you could certainly stay in Hawaii for a long time and move up. But what are you, ultimately, long term, what would you like to do in this profession? If I could place you at your kind of dream place 10 years from now, or your dream kind of life or job 10 years from now, what would you want to be doing?
My dream job is going to be at a network. And I don't necessarily have a specific one. It would be awesome if I could obviously collaborate with ESPN. That'd be amazing. And then that would be like full circle all the time. But I do think I would like to be at a network. I really have a passion for features and finding, like I said, stories like mine. So an E60 format would probably be something that I see myself down the line, more feature-esque, long-form writing versus maybe some of the other stuff. But I'm very open to, you know, not just sports. I'm open to maybe entertainment, some other stuff down the line. I don't want to just be typecasting to one thing. And if there's an opportunity where I can mix, you know, public service with TV, I will very much jump on something like that. But, yeah, I definitely see myself, hopefully, knock on wood, at a network at some point. And yeah, that's what I'm hoping will happen.
People can obviously find Francesca Weems on Twitter, and we'll link to her feed in the write-up. Francesca, how else can people, let's say if they're listening to this in California or Iowa, Maine or Texas, how can they see your work? Can they stream Hawaii News Now online?
Yeah, they can. So Hawaii News Now actually has an app, so you can download the app, and we stream all of our stuff live. And we also, you can actually go to our website and stream our broadcast live. So if you ever want to catch anything, that's going to be the best way. App, or just go to HawaiiNewsNow.com, and it's on the front page. You can stream it live. So, yeah.
Awesome.
And I'm on Twitter, at Francesca Weems.
Yeah, we will. Trust me, I'll be hyping that. That's not an issue. No podcast at Sports Illustrated hypes Twitter more than this one. That's as Jamie LaSante
I know, I
makes
love
a
it.
Face. All right, well, Francesca, listen, you know, I've interacted with you for the last couple of months. I wanted to have you on the podcast. You have a really interesting career and an interesting job right now in your late 20s, but how you got to that job is what I think a lot of people can find inspiration from, including people from disadvantaged households, kids in the foster system. I mean, I'm not just bullshitting you here. You really have a story that can help people. So when you say you want to write a book, I think you should. When you want to talk about like writing policy for Hawaii, I absolutely think you do that, because I think you have a message that goes far beyond sports casting, and I hope you continue to find forums to get it out there. I really admire what you and your brother overcame to get to where you are now.
Thank you so much. Yeah, no, that's definitely part of the plan. And I didn't get in this business for just to be the face to be out there. Like, I want to give kids, I want them to know that they can make it. They can do it. And by seeing me, even if they're not interested in sports, they're like, hey, this girl got a job. She graduated from college. If nothing else to take away, that if you work hard, you can make a dream come true. So thank you so much.
You got it. All right, Francesca Weems of Hawaii News Now. It's 6 in the morning in Hawaii. She's going to go out and watch a Laker team that should finish in 13th place in the Western Conference or something. All right, Francesca, thanks so much. Thanks for joining us on the SI Media Podcast.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
All right, back for the wrap-up. Now, Bette Marston was not here for the Francesca Weems interview. Jamie Lasante produced that. And, again, I think her story is remarkable. And, again, it just sort of teaches you about the power of perseverance and strength. And you hear about some of the things she had to go through, and you sort of laugh at your own nonsense in terms of what you think is struggling for you. Israel Gutierrez, Bette did produce, and she now joins me in the studio. Bette, what he did, that blog post, which is really interesting. You know, he could have continued in his career and would have been very successful. He is successful and, you know, didn't really have to let anybody in on what his life is away from sports media, but he did. And that's pretty, I never know if gutsy or courageous is the right word, but it's honest and open. That's what I'm trying to say. Like, when you let people in and you give something of yourself publicly, I got a lot of admiration for that. And I was, nothing else, glad to hear that most of the feedback, including social media, was positive. I think if nothing else, that says something about where we are in 2015.
Yeah, but I agree with you. He's serving as an incredible example right now. And I think that there's going to be more people in the future who are going to be navigating the same route that he is right now. But he also mentioned that as a society, we're moving closer to that not even being an issue, which is, steps for our society. And I really look forward to that future.
Yeah, and there's no doubt that, like, listen, there are gay reporters in sports out there in every medium, from digital to print to television. They may not be out, but they exist. Trust me on that. And that's why I think the more inclusion that we have, and the more, the one thing he said, and he's right about this, and Bette, you're younger than me, you're in your 20s. Athletes who are of that age it's not even anecdotal. They've just grown up in a different world where they see gay characters on television. Their family may have out gay members. They may have friends in college who are gay. So these issues they're just different. I don't think interviewing an athlete about a gay reporter interviewing an athlete in 1955 is obviously going to be immeasurably different than a gay reporter interviewing an athlete in 2015.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think the athletes have any issue with it. And he's in the NBA. It's a pretty progressive league.
Very.
Correct
right.
me if I'm wrong. But Definitely. And I think it's he's not going to – I don't think he's going to have any sort of issues. And,
I don't think he'd have – actually, I probably should have been better in my questions on this. I don't think he's going to have any issues with the NBA community. What he could have issues with, and maybe I should have asked this, was I do think there are going to be yahoos who see him on television – and then through Twitter and Facebook, do what Yahoo's do, calling him gay, like using gay slurs and stuff like that. I don't think he's gonna care, but I would be surprised if that didn't happen, because you just see it happen with women in the business,
absolutely,
all the time on social media. So, but again,
that hasn't gone away yet.
And ultimately, that doesn't matter, because ultimately, what matters is performance for him, and how his employers, at least in terms of professionally.
I think that was really cool that Skip Bayless emailed him. Said congratulations.
Not Skip Bayless, John Skipper.
John Skipper, damn it.
Yeah, I agree. Don't edit that out. John Skipper, the president of ESPN, emailed him, and that I agree with you. That was really impressive, and as did Adam Silver, commissioner of the NBA.
That was
very awesome.
Yeah, I absolutely.
That. All right, we'll end it on
that. I think that actually says more about him. Like, he is very well known around the NBA and highly respected. You know,
the one thing about the NBA, the one thing about the leagues is that the people who are national broadcasters, the commissioners know. So, like, Roger Goodell knows who Michel Tafoya is.
Right.
He knows who Ian Eagle is. In the same way Adam Silver knows Doris Burke, you know, Mike Breen, Van Gundy, Gutierrez. You got to, because they're pushing your product to the market. All right, Ben. This has probably been the longest exit we've had.
That's fine.
Dan Bloom will not be happy. All right, upcoming podcast guests include Paul Heyman of the WWE and Jay Onwright of Fox Sports One, or FS1, as it is now known. Thank you for the great feedback on previous podcasts, from Mike Hill to Susie Colbert to Katie Nolan, to all the ones that we've done, Adam Schefter, Vern Lundquist, Rachel Nichols. You can check those out on iTunes, on SoundCloud. Please give feedback to Bette Marston and I on Twitter, whether the feedback is good or bad. We want it. We want to help our show. Our thanks to Slate and Panoply, our partners at Sports Illustrated Podcast. And we'll be back next week with the greatest performer on television, the WWE's Paul Heyman. This is Richard Deitch. We'll see you then.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.